Politics aside, being a woman is hard. When it comes to our ever-changing menstrual cycle, perimenopause, or menopause, we could use support, and that's where Happy Mammoth comes in. Remember that awful week before your period where you feel off and look in the mirror and don't recognize your reflection and you want to crawl out of your own skin? I don't. Estro Control by Happy Mammoth has made managing PMS symptoms so much easier. And for my friends who are going through menopause or perimenopause, or even if you've come out the other side and still feel like a wet sock on a busy highway, Hormone Harmony is a lifesaver. It's not just me saying this, it's become a phenomenon. Women can't stop talking about it on social media, and a bottle is sold every 24 seconds. The secret? Happy Mammoth uses only science-backed ingredients, including adaptogens, which help your body adapt to the stressors of hormonal changes. It's not just for menopause either. Any woman with hormonal imbalances can benefit. Imagine getting relief from hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, and poor sleep. And the best part, feeling like yourself again. With over 17,000 reviews, this isn't just hype. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code RAIN for 15% off. It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out. True Crime Fest Northwest is just a few weeks away, and you can get your tickets now at truecrimefestnorthwest.com. What can you expect from the inaugural event? On Friday, August 30th, attendees can check out the Expo Hall before enjoying a kickoff presentation and self-defense training from Rose City Self-Defense. On Saturday, you'll have another chance to get swag from your favorite podcasters and true crime creators in the Expo Hall. Presentations on Saturday include, but are not limited to, Desiree Young, who is Kyron Horman's mother, United Justice Group, which is family members of victims of accused serial killer Jesse Calhoun, our friends Sisters in Survival, a.k.a. Tiffany Edens and Danielle Tudor, the National Center for Victims of Crime, authors Lindsay Wade and Rebecca Morris, and some of your favorite podcasts like PNW Haunts and Homicides, A Hateful Homicide, Somewhere in the Pines, Snake River Killer, and of course, Murder in the Rain, among others. And those are just some of the scheduled appearances. Saturday night will also be the time for the VIP party. Sunday, the festivities continue with presentations, a drag bingo raffle fundraiser, and a VIP brunch. So get to truecrimefestnorthwest.com, use code RAIN10 for 10% off, and get your tickets today. And vendors, there's still time to sign up for a table. Visit TrueCrimeFestNorthwest.com and get your tickets now.
True Crime Fest Northwest.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. That May is Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I wanted to share a story that would highlight violence against those in the AAPI communities. Then I remembered one of the very first cases I covered way back in September of 2019, the Hell's Canyon Massacre. Since that time, the story has received more media coverage, and my research abilities have vastly improved. So I wanted to revisit the case and share even more of the story of Hell's Canyon and how it isn't a hidden shadow in Oregon's history, but rather a cornerstone to its racist foundation. A friendly reminder that all of our older episodes from before fall of 2020 are still available for free via our Patreon or on YouTube. So today we'll start with some AAPI Heritage Month history, the history of Chinese people in Oregon, some crimes from the time, and those backgrounds will help paint a picture as to what the environment was then and how the Deep Creek Massacre came to be. Emily, I was looking this up and I didn't see the exact number, but I think the original Hell's Canyon was my fifth episode.
Yeah.
And when I pulled it up, I was like, yeah, I want to revisit that because I know I didn't have as much information. And it was 6 pages long.
I know. It was like mine with the Green River Killer. I thought it was really long. And yeah. I was like, it's five pages.
Oh, yeah. I did not know how to research back then. Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, or AAPI History or Heritage Month, goes back to 1877, when a week in May was designated as a time to commemorate accomplishments made by AAPI Americans. 1 week was bumped up to 10 days, but arguments were made forcing it to return to being a week, May 4th through 11th. The first official AAPI week was under President Carter in 1979. It wouldn't be until 1990 that the first request to make the celebration a month long was presented. Amazingly, especially for a World War II veteran, it was President Bush Sr. who would issue the first proclamation declaring May 1990 the first AAPI Heritage Month. You might be wondering why May was chosen as the month to acknowledge AAPI Americans. Well, it's an important month in AAPI history. May 7th, 1843 was the date the first Japanese immigrants arrived in the U.S., and on May 10th, 1869, the first transcontinental railroad in the U.S. was completed, which could not have been done without the Chinese pioneers who put their blood, sweat, tears, and literal lives into its construction. It's estimated that in the construction of the Central Pacific, aka the Transcontinental Railroad, somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 Chinese workers were killed due to natural elements like avalanches, rock slides, and exposure, and human elements like the explosions used to clear mountains and violence between the men. Comprised of 216,918 acres that originally belonged to the Nez Perce tribes of the area, at 72 miles long and at points 10 miles wide, the Hell's Canyon area is a sight to behold. Comprised of 216,981 acres that originally belonged to the Nez Perce tribes of the area. At 7,993 feet at its deepest point, Hell's Canyon is the deepest river gorge in North America. And yes, it's even deeper than the Grand Canyon by nearly 2,000 feet. The exact location where today's story took place was in a portion of the canyon known as Deep Creek. To get there from Portland, you would stay on the 84, headed east, passing through the Dalles and Wallowa. After 325 miles or so, you would wind up in Enterprise, Oregon. From Enterprise, there is a 50 or so mile drive northeast to the location where the Snake River, which doubles as the Oregon-Idaho border, and the Imnaha River meet. And because of the events that transpired, the location has officially been renamed as Chinese Massacre Cove. The canyon originally had nice enough names like Snake River Canyon and Box Canyon. Then H.W. McCurdy's Marine History of the Pacific Northwest was published in 1895. Because of a turbulent steamboat ride through the canyon, McCurdy dubbed it Hell's Canyon. Almost 40 years later, the Mazama Hiking Club, which if you listened to my Patreon episode 9 Strangers, you know all about, a book called Hell's Canyon came out in 43, and when Senator Nurburger of Oregon used that term several times when speaking to news outlets back in the 30s, the name was sealed. Based on pictographs, petroglyphs, and Clovis points, which are prehistoric arrowheads, it's believed humans could have been living near the canyon as far back as 15,000 years ago. This is a drop in the bucket of time compared to how long ago underwater volcanoes were forming the canyon, which was like 150 million years ago. Also forming the canyon is the Snake River. Originating in Yellowstone, the river makes its way through Idaho, turns north, and ends up in Pasco, Washington, where it joins the Columbia River. Because of its width, length, and water movement, the Snake River is the sixth in the U.S. for river volume. Thanks to the USDA, we know that it was a hand sign utilized by the first Americans that inspired the snake name. Those people would eventually be recognized as being part of the Shoshone tribe. In the Pacific Northwest, from British Columbia through Oregon, Washington, and Northern California, there was a huge influx of Chinese immigrants during the Gold Rush, which kicked off in late 1848. Stories traveled across the globe. Many heard the tales of unimaginable amounts of gold, and many wanted their piece of the pie. The motive to mine was most often as a means to help the families the men would be leaving behind. To accomplish this, thousands of men entered into agreements with gold companies. The company would pay for their transportation, a 6,000-mile unpleasant ship ride across the Pacific, and in turn, the man who made the deal would have to work for said company until they, at the very least, had worked off the debt the trip had incurred. The first European colonizers to arrive in Oregon had done so in 1811. Statehood would come in 1859, by which time the gold rush had technically ended, but gold mining and panning was still happening, with fruitful results. During the years of the rush, the population of Chinese immigrants in Oregon had exploded from 3,000 in 1870, some of which were the first non-natives to come to the territory, up to 10,000 just a decade later. This rapid influx started to panic the white folks that were frantically claiming the land. What I wrote 5 years ago and what happened 150 years ago still rings true today. Because the white folks were fearful of the unfamiliar Chinese, rumors and fear-mongering regarding safety, violence, and the loss of jobs for white men to the Chinese were spread. Now, to be fair, the white men were losing their jobs to the Chinese men, but this was due to the fact that the latter were willing to work harder jobs for less pay. The white men also took issue with the plan many Chinese immigrants had made for themselves. They weren't immigrating into the country with a goal of laying down roots and building up a life and stimulating the U.S. economy. Many were there to work hard, doing hard work for a decade or so. They would live by the cheapest means possible to save all the money that they were paid for mining. Once they were content with their savings, the men would take it back home for their families. This difference in cultures gave birth to Chinatowns. Within these designated neighborhoods, the Chinese people lived amongst each other, carrying on the traditions they brought from home. Some opened businesses, many shared homes and apartments. The tight-knit communities would assist one another with housing, food, meeting all necessary needs. Almost all the immigrants from China were men, as the restrictions for Chinese women getting into the country were even more difficult than it was for the men. So here you had large groups of young, strong, working men living together. In their free time, some of these guys would gamble, smoke opium, pay for sex workers. All of that helped to stoke the fears of the pearl-clutching white folks. Not only were the Chinese men living a salacious lifestyle, or one that was perceived as being so, but the fears were compounded by the strange clothes, hair, and skin of these men. Those differences and the rising concerns and complaints from the white population forced the government to step in. If you've been listening to this show since I first told this story, you're well aware of how racist Oregon's history is. Sure, us tree-hugging granola crunchers like to think that we live in what has always been a peaceful, loving state. We fool ourselves by thinking, well, Oregon didn't have sit-ins or bus boycotts, so we must not have been racist. The difference between the Jim Crow states in the South and the Pacific Northwest is that the racism in the South was in your face. The fountains were designated between races. Those states wouldn't let a person of color sit in certain restaurants. Oregon wouldn't let a person of color into the state. When the Oregon Constitution was created in 1859, it included a special section dedicated to Chinese people, and not in a nice way. It read in part, "No Chinaman, not a resident of the state at the adoption of this Constitution, shall ever hold any real estate or mining claims or work any mining claim therein." Meaning that if you weren't settled in the state by 1859, you would not be permitted to buy land or claim any part of a mine. These racist laws made home and land ownership nearly impossible, but not opening businesses. In fact, some of the first businesses in downtown Portland were Chinese-owned laundry facilities, which of course were used plenty by the white people who were keeping the owners from participating in the American dream. The racism went federal in 1882 when the United States Congress created the Chinese Exclusion Act. This act barred Chinese workers from entering the country altogether. Lobbyists preyed upon the rumors and fears by claiming the law would help quell the violence that was supposedly so prevalent on the West Coast. While most violent incidents were initiated by white people toward a Chinese person, there are, of course, documented incidents showing that it was initiated by a Chinese person. But I think this op-ed, though racist and kind of ignorant overall, has good intentions, even 144 years later. From 1879, a boy was stabbed by a Chinaman on a street in this city one evening last week, and the act has justly been spoken of as a criminal outrage. But in the comment we have heard, the censure has not been properly divided. It's not strange that an affair of this kind should grow out of the ill treatment of the Chinese, which has become so common in this city. There is a class of boy who should be severely dealt with for annoying, pelting, and otherwise mistreating the Chinese. That these persecuted creatures should turn upon their tormentors sometimes is only natural, and it would be laudable, too, if they would in every case give the boys a sound drubbing, not resorting to deadly or dangerous weapons. In this case, the boy who was hurt appeared to not have been at fault, but the Chinaman supposed he was one of the party assailing him and struck accordingly. The two boys who were pelting the Chinaman are the real culprits. It would be hard, perhaps impossible, to find any case of this kind in which the Chinese are the aggressors. Almost every day, Chinese are assaulted upon in the streets by vicious boys, and the wonder is that serious consequences do not more frequently happen. Yet the police, so far as we are aware, never arrest boys who make these assaults. Justice and regard for the public peace require that in every instance they should be arrested and punished. Parents will be likely to take more interest in the behavior of their sons if they are obligated, every time, to pay fines for their misconduct. The argument that the Chinese are not a desirable class of population furnishes no reason for treating them with unjust violence and cruelty. The boys who are allowed to do so are taking lessons for future practice without discrimination of race. If they can't be taught at home that this is not manly to make these assaults upon a race because of its inferiority, they ought to get a sound thrashing at the hands of the Chinese every time and be locked up in the city jail into the bargain. While this Chinaman had no right to strike with a knife and should be punished therefore, the opportunity should not be lost for impressing a lesson on the boys' parents and police. I get what they're saying.
Yeah, it's a fair assumption.
They're obviously seeing it through the lens of the 1800s, but sure. They're saying it's so prevalent that everyone sees these gangs of young men, I mean, children even, who are actively assaulting Chinese people.
And it's not apologizing on behalf of the person who did wrong as well with stabbing, but it's like acknowledging there's a wider issue.
Yeah, and it's saying, well, no wonder. Wouldn't you stab somebody too if this group wouldn't leave you alone?
And I imagine a lot of people didn't like that.
Yeah.
Because that sounds too progressive.
Yeah, tell me how to handle my kids.
What year was that?
This was 1879.
Wow, that is astounding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Spank your boys and stop letting them be racist. Unsurprisingly, there are more stories of violence toward people from China because the exclusion laws had the opposite effect. Perpetrating the lies surrounding the Chinese people as a whole, tensions across the country grew, and just like we've seen in the last couple of years, there was a rise in attacks toward Asian people. I've got a couple more snippets here from newspapers from the late 1800s, so just like we had in the last one, there will be outdated and racist language, and some portions were illegible. So For those who, like myself, did not know that the term celestial was used as a way to reference Chinese people, it was, and it comes from an old name for China, which was the Celestial Empire. In the 1800s, it became a term used across the world. I apologize in advance for the language being used, but I think it's important to share how dismissed these people were. From San Francisco, March 1870. This morning early, a Chinaman was found in a dying condition in a vacant lot off of Brannan Street. Officers started with him in a wagon to the hospital, but before they got there, he died. The body was taken to the coroner's. The body bore no signs of violence. Also from San Francisco, about 10 o'clock last night, two white men attacked a Chinaman on Clay Street. They knocked him down on the sharp edge of the curb, inflicting injuries which proved fatal in a short time. The names of those men were in the article, and two men were arrested, but I could not find anything additional about them. So I doubt that they ever faced time for basically curb stomping that man to death. The article did go on to say the name of the Chinaman has not yet been learned by the authorities. The police last night extended their raid on Chinamen to women in the houses of ill fame and captured 56 of their number. They are now in prison. The Chinaman murdered last night is not yet identified. From Portland, 1875, we are informed that a most dastardly and unprovoked assault was committed on a Chinaman by a young man on Thursday evening in the upper portion of the city. The name of the man who perpetrated the unwarranted outrage on the Celestial is Daughtry. The circumstances connected to the case are about as follows. On Thursday evening, a Chinaman was quietly passing along the street with a basket of clothes on his back when suddenly he was assaulted by a small lad named Daughtry, a younger brother of the person who committed the assault, who continued to pelt him with stones and clots. The Chinaman attempted to get away from the assailant, but finding that his apparent something of courage only emboldened the young vandal in his attacks. Unintelligible, set his basket of clothes on the sidewalk and made preparations to act on the defensive. Just then, Daughtry approached and threw several stones, which struck him. This infuriated the Chinaman, who rushed inside nearby and, picking up an axe, handled in a threatening manner toward Daughtry, who, finding that he had woken the wrong passenger, bent a hasty retreat. Daughtry was not arrested, and the man got help from people in the area, and he was all right. Near Ridgefield, Washington, 1882, the body of a Chinaman, badly decomposed, was found floating in the slough at the head of Bachelor's Island on Monday the 15th. The nearest justice of the peace was notified, and an inquest was held immediately. The verdict was to the effect that the Chinaman had been suffocated by violence, as a heavy woolen cloth was found sewed tightly over his mouth and nostrils. The Celestial was about 5 feet tall and had on a knit undershirt and drawers and blue overalls. The body was buried on the bank of the slough. Just like with the indigenous people of Yakima, there were several articles I found about bodies just being found in the water. Some were dismissed as drowning, some were violent, like this previous one. And it's hard to imagine how much of an investigation was done for any of them, especially that last one where they just buried him where they found him. Okay, now listen to the wording on this one about a man attacking a garden. And think about how dismissive the reports of violence against the Chinese were when you listen to the drama. This is from Portland, 1872. This peaceful and orderly community about Monticello was thrown into a great confusion by the sudden appearance of a wild Chinaman in the vicinity on last Saturday. A man reading near Monticello observed a wild and crazy-looking Chinaman in his garden to the rear of his house last Saturday. The Celestial wore a wild, strange countenance. His queue was unbraided and hung in confused locks about his person, and he was clad literally in rags. When observed, he had an axe in his hands, and he was slashing into the gardener's corn, cabbage, and pumpkins, and committing sad destruction among the vegetables. The man rightly surmised that the creature was either wild or crazy, and he resolved to put something to his wanton ravages. Knowing that to approach a crazy Chinaman armed with an axe would not be unattended with danger, he took a weapon and started for the reckless heathen. When within about 20 yards of the lunatic, the man shouted for him to stop, at the same time brandishing his weapon in a threatening manner. The Chinaman was so deeply engaged in his work of destruction that he did not observe the owner's approach. On hearing the man's voice and perceiving that he was healed for any emergency, the lunatic fled precipitously from the place. He leapt the garden enclosure, disappeared into the timber nearby, and was seen no more. The rest of the story goes that the man ran off. He found a pot of stew being cooked in a home nearby. He demanded the food while at the same time striking the pot with the axe, which fell to the floor. He then ran away. The shocked cook grabbed a shotgun and followed the guy in an effort to protect local women and children. The cook wound up at a farmhouse, and there was no sign of the man, so he started to walk back home through the woods when he came upon the man with the axe, so he fired at him, landing buckshot into his thigh. But he continued. The cook then slammed the man into the ground, knocking him out. When he woke up, things were worse. Shouts soon brought several men from the camp, and the Celestial was brought in. As soon as he recovered his breath, he fought like a wild beast and was so furious that the men were compelled to confine him in an old barn nearby, where he was chained securely and his food was slipped through a crack. The poor creature was kept several days, raving from the wandering of his reason and the delirium caused by his fever and wounds. A physician was sent from Kalama on Monday, who went over and dressed his wounds. At the latest accounts of the Chinaman, he is still kept chained like a tiger, no one offering to take any care of him or pay for his passage to the city or elsewhere. The authorities of that territory should be notified of the facts and the wounded and demented person removed to a place of safety where he can be restrained from acts of violence and receive the needed medical attention. Again, this man wielded an axe, damaged some personal crops and a pot of food for which he was chained to a wall for who knows how long. May have died there. There's no telling. Now, this one has to be the most upsetting and bizarre. From Portland, 1887. Yesterday morning, Eddie Spitzenberger, a 9-year-old son of John Spitzenberger, the grocer at Porter and Corbett Streets, died. After the death of the boy had been announced, the children in the neighborhood reported that on or about Friday last, a lot of boys annoyed a Chinaman who, becoming exasperated, chased them and caught young Spitzenberger, who was the smallest of the lot, and holding him by the head, raised him with considerable violence from the ground and then dropped him. The shaking the boy received is said to have resulted in him being taken down with a swollen neck and the cause of his death. This report was common talk in the neighborhood yesterday. Dr. Henry E. Jones, who attended to the lad, was interviewed on the subject and stated positively that the boy died of natural causes, namely an untreatable type of fever. I take all of these stories with a grain of salt, especially about the boy who died of natural causes, but there were claims of an attack surrounding his death. It seemed easy and common to pin stories of death or violence on the men from China. Or as we saw with the garden attacker, someone having a mental health crisis, or maybe he was sick from those wounds being infected, it could be totally dismissed because of their looks or race. A couple of other stories from the time. In September of 1885, a mob in Wyoming attacked and killed 28 Chinese coal miners. In Portland, 50 masked men beat workers and destroyed their camp. In Jackson, Oregon, 1877, armed men surrounded a cabin full of Chinese workers, setting fire to it and shooting at the men as they ran out to escape the flames. In February 1886, about 40 men, most of which were members of racist organizations, came together in Oregon City. Holding a meeting at the Phoenix Hotel, they came to the decision that they would rid Oregon City of all Chinese people. From the Phoenix, they went to the Washington Hotel, a place known as a house for mill workers from China. Breaking into the rooms, the white men woke the sleeping miners and forced them outside. They were all made to walk to the Willamette River, where their ride, a steamboat, awaited them. About 50 Chinese men were forced onto the boat, which would head north to Portland. For those unfamiliar, it would only be about 10 miles on the river, and you would end up at the south end of Portland. Though most of the men involved in perpetrating the eviction were known by name, no one was arrested or charged for the harassment and forced expulsion. This idea of forcing the Chinese people onto a steamboat and out of town may have been inspired by our neighbors up north, as the act was referred to as the Tacoma Method. In Tacoma, 1885, there was a planned expulsion. A deadline of November 1st was given to the Chinese citizens of Tacoma, and they would have to leave. At 1:30 p.m. on the 3rd, when they hadn't left, the local men, including political leaders, police officers, and other prominent local figures, joined forces. This mob consisted of several hundred men who started marching in the street. They kicked in the doors of businesses and homes. They grabbed all the Chinese men, women, and children and pushed them into the street. The mayor at the time, Jacob Weisbach, a very racist German, if you can believe that, was the leader of what would go on to be called the Tacoma Riots, and he happily reported that, quote, more than 200 Chinese people were forced out of Tacoma that night. In the pouring rain, 200 people who had been dragged out of their homes and businesses had to walk 8 miles to the local train station, where they were forced to then buy their own ticket for Portland. Those who wouldn't or couldn't buy a ticket would either have to hop on a boxcar or walk the 140 miles south. Amazingly, it's reported that only 2 men died from exposure to the elements.
You know, it's nice. Things really have changed. They don't have to pay for their tickets anymore. Greg Abbott will just pay for that.
That's
for them.
Right. After clearing out the Chinese people, the men in town burned down the buildings within Tacoma's Chinatown, leveling it. While the German society in town celebrated the mayor's actions with a ball, arrests were eventually made. The mayor, along with 26 other men, were arrested and charged with federal conspiracy. But as we've seen, even to this day and age, someone in a leadership position being arrested doesn't always equal consequences or justice. In fact, the men known as the Tacoma 27 were cheered on by their community members, and fundraisers were held to help pay for their legal fees. The trial for the 27 was scheduled for the following year, but a technicality led to the charges being dropped. Hoping for a new trial, only 10 men were charged in the second go. Then those charges were dropped. In the end, a grand jury failed to indict any of the men, and they only found more local support through the years, earning hero status and remaining in politics. So for anyone who has ever wondered why Tacoma is so Tacoma-y, that might be part of it.
I'm glad you put it in there. I was just going to say that.
That's some real Tacoma.
Yeah.
It's its own culture.
Yes.
Here are the names of the 27 so they can be shamed for all of time. C.E. King, George Robert Epperson, E. Von Schrader, Michael Lewis McAtee, Meyer Kaufman, Thomas L. Nixon, Amadeus Rodunzel, John Budlong, Jacob Ralph, Dolphus B. Hanna.
What?
Adalbert Uriah
Mills. What? You're making these up.
I'm not. Adalbert Uriah Mills, Ben R. Everett, John Comerford, Mayor Jacob Weisbach, George D. Lawson, Olaf Anderson, Harry A. Stevens, Eli G. Bacon, H.C. Patrick, Frank McGill, John Forbes, Henry S. Bixler, Augustus W. Cohn, Louis Stimson, William Christie, M.C. McGills, J.N. Fernandez, and James Wickersham.
John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt.
I would like to thank, and I highly recommend, visiting TacomaMethod.com. They have a lot more detail about each man involved, and they have photos. Awesome research. Very helpful website. Some of the professions held by the members of the Tacoma 27 were a deputy marshal, the owner of the Tacoma News, real estate agents, blacksmiths, carpenters, a fire chief and a firefighter, a saloon owner, journalists, newspaper editors, butchers, a city council member, laborer, shoemaker, military serviceman, and a lawyer who would go on to become a judge. Seeing so many racists working in the media, it starts to become a little more understandable why the stories of attacks were written so differently depending on who was the perpetrator.
I really hope the shoemaker's last name was Schumacher.
Oh, I bet it was.
Better be.
I can go to TacomaMethod.com and see. Many leaders from around the area supported the Tacoma Method. Sylvester Penior, who would become Oregon's governor in 1887 and the mayor of Portland in 1896, was a vocal supporter of everything anti-Chinese. He was a supporter of the Tacoma Method. He was an outspoken supporter of not just the Confederacy during the Civil War, but slavery. When he ran for office, his slogan became, "Keep the Mongolians out." The year before he was elected to the governorship, he was one of the men in those groups who was trying to commit an expulsion of Chinese people from Portland. In 1886, inspired by Tacoma's actions, Seattle followed suit, forcing 350 Chinese people onto wagons, which were taken to the docks, where the people were demanded to board a steamboat, which was scheduled for San Francisco. Amazingly, Governor Watson Squire tried to stop the kidnapping/deportation/expulsion, and he initiated martial law. This led to a federal intervention and a much longer story. Sadly, many of those who had been driven out of their homes were still forced out of the state. This is because the governor wasn't really being nice. He would go on to be elected to the Senate when Washington became a state and used his own anti-Chinese stance as his platform. Olympia then followed suit in February of 1886. Citizens drafted a resolution that read in part, Be it resolved. While we fully realize the fact that we have too much of the Chinese element in our midst, we clearly recognize the fact that they are herein and by virtue of law and treaty stipulations, and that we are decidedly opposed to their expulsion by force or by intimidation or by any other unlawful means, but we will at all times give our aid and support to any measures looking to a peaceable and lawful riddance of that element and a final solution of the Chinese question. So basically, they're saying, we don't want to cause a riot or physically drive people out. We just want to figure out how to make the Chinese folks feel really uncomfortable to where maybe they'll leave on their own. And it's always comforting to read anything race-related that ends with final solution. Some rioters did try the Tacoma method, hoping to drive the Chinese out in one swoop, but local folks and even the sheriff got involved to stop it. I'm not saying that they were flawless. They happily permitted harassment toward Chinese people. But the sheriff did deputize some folks who ended up arresting those who initiated the riot. They were charged, went to trial, found guilty, and wound up on McNeil Island. So good job, Olympia. Portland wasn't any safer for the Chinese. The night of the Oregon City expulsion, there was a march with 3,500 people holding signs that read the counterintuitive, "Slavery must not exist here" in 1886, and "The Chinese must go." During this time, Chinese-owned businesses were often the targets of dynamite attacks. Luckily, the Oregonian's editor, Harvey Scott, was not on board for the expulsion or the riots, and he was able to, through the newspaper, quell the upheavals. It helped that the mayor and a judge were also strong supporters of the Chinese and were against the violent movements taking place. This led to Portland and Astoria becoming unofficial havens for the local Chinese Americans. Just before the chaos kicked off in Washington, Colorado miners from England and Sweden set the standard by driving hundreds of Chinese mine workers into the desert. During this expulsion, 15 men were hurt and 28 were murdered. And these, of course, are far from the only events of this nature in the Pacific Northwest. Because Lewiston is the easternmost seaport for the Pacific at 500 miles inland, and it's connected to so many rivers, and there were rumors of gold going around in the 1800s, it was no surprise the small town saw an influx in population, especially of the Chinese people, around that time. I know that this has been a lot of bummer information, but the history of the time is important not only to the context of today's case, but to the context of today's climate. The stories I just told were considered the bigger stories of violence against Chinese people. That was until some office cleaning done by a county clerk unveiled an even more shocking event. Charlotte McIver, said clerk, was cleaning out an old safe in her Wallawa office. She was planning on getting rid of the clunky safe, so she opened it up and found some mysterious documents. As she flipped through the papers, she couldn't tell if these had been lost to time or, more likely, hidden from history. The documents were given to local historians who began putting the pieces together. What they thought had been a known story about maybe 10 Chinese workers being murdered turned out to be far worse. This was the story of a horrific massacre in which at least 31, but probably closer to 34 Chinese workers were killed, making it the largest massacre of Chinese people by white settlers in U.S. history. It would take until 10 years after that initial discovery to get a better idea as to what had transpired. Author R. Gregory Noakes did a fantastic write-up about the events. He found the official trial record in a county planning department's basement underneath volumes of century-old tax assessor records. By the summer of 1887, the traditional California gold rush had quieted down, but miners were continuing to search for riches. In the area of the Snake and Salmon Rivers in Idaho, miners from around the world were on the hunt for flour gold. Flour gold is the most difficult to mine or pan for, due primarily to its microscopic size. There's a reason the treasure is called flour gold, fine gold, or dust gold. The flakes are about the size of a grain of sand and are often found mixed with the sand in riverbed crevices. The worth of the flakes comes from their density. Because of the rushing waters, it's the denser flakes of gold that stay in place. Panning even a small piece of flour gold might be more valuable than a less dense, larger piece. Seeking their fortune in gold of any size was a group of Chinese workers. In the fall of 1886, the group of men began the arduous journey up the Snake River. Using pulley systems, poles, and flat-bottomed boats to carry their supplies, they entered the Snake River and started making their way upstream, against the current. Their small boats even survived the Mountain Sheep and Wild Goose Rapids. And after 65 miles upriver, the men finally made it to their final destination, Deep Creek. Once they found an ideal stopping point, they set up camp, erecting tents and claiming nearby caves. There wasn't much known about the miners except some of their names and that they were employed by the Sam Yup Company. Sam Yup was headquartered in San Francisco but was part of a larger Chinese company. So I don't think it would be outlandish to assume the miners could have been taking part in the work for the company in the U.S. and go home with more money exchange program. It's also reasonable to believe the men had come to the U.S. before the Chinese Exclusion Act, meaning they had been there at least 5 years. I apologize in advance, but I do want to share their names. So the few names that were known were Kong Mun Kao, Kong Nan, Che Po, who was a leader of one of the groups, Che Sun, Che Yao, Che Shun, Che Chong, Che Ling, Che Chao, and Che Lin Chung. And because all of those names had Che, it is believed that they were related. And it's also thought that those men all came from the same area in southeastern China. Those who lived in the Deep Creek area knew nothing of the men. It wasn't unusual for groups to be on the river mining for gold and any other treasured materials they came across. The exact amount of gold the men found after 8 months of mining was unknown, but it's estimated to have been around $4,000 to $5,000 worth, which today would be about $160,000. Winter and spring in Lewiston came and went. Summer in the canyon started as usual. That was until June 11, 1887. According to the very small paragraph on page 3 of the 4-page Lewiston Teller nearly a week later, something nefarious had occurred. On the following Thursday, just below a report about a man who came down the Salmon River to give a snow report, and above the story about a local theater group leaving town, was the shocking news. The article read, "A boatload of Chinamen came down the Snake River on Saturday last and brought the news that another boatload of Chinese had been murdered about 150 miles above here by some unknown parties. They claim that the Chinamen, 10 in number, who were murdered, had upwards of $3,000 on them, having been mining on the river for the past year. They found their boat with blankets and provisions in, and but three of the Chinamen have been found, and these in the river, two of whom were shot and the third could not be captured. Many think the Chinamen murdered them, while others think Indians or whites, but the mystery may never be solved." And you gotta love that kind of dismissive ending. Probably never solve it. About a week and a half after the deaths were announced, the bodies started washing ashore. Over the next several days, 8 bodies had come floating down the river. Once the bodies and the story of the murders made it to the towns, a search and rescue operation was put in place. As reported in the Lewiston Teller on June 30th, J.K. Vincent, who was a justice of the peace and a U.S. commissioner, which I'll talk about in a little bit, and a Chinese merchant left here on Monday last in a small boat for Riparia, which is a town in Washington. It's about 400 miles northwest from Deep Creek as the crow flies, to procure the bodies of the Chinamen that were found in the river. They succeeded in getting one of the bodies, which they brought up on Thursday's boat, and the same was buried in the Chinese cemetery near the city. We are informed that the body was brutally mangled, having 2 gunshot wounds in the back, 1 arm partly cut off, and the head nearly severed from the body. Other bodies were seen in the drift, but will be unable to be taken out until the water goes down. Before Joseph and Leloy, a man mostly used as a translator who had been hired by the Sam Yup Company, made their way to the scene, they found the bodies which had initially been discovered by the other party of the Chinese men, those referenced in the initial article reporting the deaths, and they noted that boats had been destroyed, ropes and supplies were floating in the water, and several of the bodies appeared to have axe wounds. This was while the bodies were still on land, so this could be confirmation the men were mutilated by the attackers and not the water. When the two men arrived at Deep Creek, they found other bodies. One was in a boat, some were in the water. The whole campsite was a scene of blood and battle. It was clear something terrible had taken place. Checking the bodies that they could access, there was a pattern. 2 bullet holes either in their heads or their head and back. The bodies that washed ashore had traveled 65 miles downstream. It would be hard for a medical examiner today to be able to decipher the difference in injuries from an axe attack and 2 weeks decomposition in a river with rapids, let alone taking into account whatever education a medical examiner had living in the rural parts of Idaho in the late 1800s. So this left it unclear as to if axes were used and if anyone was nearly decapitated as part of the violent attack, or if those injuries were post-mortem and had occurred naturally while they traveled through the violent waters. This mass casualty event had Joseph Vincent starting an investigation. He was chosen to do so as he was a U.S. commissioner, and the Sam Yup Company had requested he find out what led to the massacre of their employees. The miners had gone up the river and hiked through the canyon in hopes of not only finding gold, but to escape the mobs that were running people of their nationality out of their homes. Being in cities felt unsafe. They thought the miles of water would protect them, but white supremacy has a way of worming its way into every gold-filled crevasse. Among the documents recovered in the old safe were the testimonies given to a grand jury. It showed 18-year-old Frank Vaughn was the first to confess to having knowledge about the massacre, and he quickly flipped on his partners. As state's evidence, he turned in the other six men while claiming that he himself had only watched the murders. Frank named his co-conspirators. They were J. Titus Tidy Canfield, who was 21, Robert McMillan, who was 15, Hezekiah Carl Hughes, who was 37, Hiram Maynard, 38, Bruce Blue Evans, who was 31, and Homer Omar LaRue, whose age was unknown. This wasn't a random group of friends that found themselves out on the river and happened to decide to kill a group of men. This was a horse thieving gang. The grift they had been focusing on for the previous year was stealing horses from Oregon, forcing them to swim across the Snake River, then selling said horses in the Idaho area. The ringleader was a man known as B.E., Bruce, or Blue, Evans. At 31 years old, he was already infamous for his horse-thieving habits and the belief that he may have committed a murder years earlier. Blue might have first started his large-scale horse-thievery when he was asked to help a fellow rancher with his 1,000 horses, from which he stole about 150. As for that other murder, some years prior to the Deep Creek killings, a man named TJ and his partner robbed a stagecoach, during which the partner was shot and killed. The man on the coach was injured. TJ left both behind and took a box containing three gold bars, one report claiming the haul was worth $75,000. But I did do a little bit of math, but it's me doing math, so who knows. But it looked like it'd be closer to about $25,000, which is nothing to turn your nose up at, as it would have been about $1 million today. After the robbery, TJ wound up in Oregon, right at the Idaho border and just north of Deep Creek. Fun fact, that area was a common hiding place for robbers and thieves because of its easy access to Idaho and Oregon via the river. And that location would go on to be named Doug Bar, D-U-G, in honor of TJ Douglas. When word spread that TJ was around and he was probably in possession of a chunk of change, Blue Evans and Titus Tidy Canfield made their way to Doug Bar, found TJ, and either together or Blue acting on his own, killed him and took the gold. Neither man was ever charged for the murder of TJ Douglas. Of course, there is more information available surrounding all of the men accused of perpetrating the attack than there is for the victims. At the time, Tidy Canfield was 21. His parents were some of the original colonizers of Wallowa County. At the time of the murders, he and his family lived very close to Blue Evans. Frank Vaughn was between 18 to 21 years old. He and his family were quite respected in town, so much so that just days before Deep Creek, Frank was deputized as to serve Blue Evans with a subpoena ordering him to testify about Tidy Canfield's horse thievery. Frank Vaughn claimed to have ridden over 100 miles in search of Blue, but he was never able to find or therefore serve him. Hiram Maynard was the oldest member of the gang. At 38 years old, he worked for Blue. Homer Omar LaRue was reported to have been taken under the wing of Frank Vaughn's uncle, which then placed him in the gang's inner circle. The youngest of the group was Robert McMillan. He was only 15 years old. He likely became part of Blue's gang after Robert's sister, Josephine, married Blue. Two men in Wallowa County, H. Ross Findlay and J. Harland Horner, each made documented accounts regarding the murders and perpetrators, leaving behind documents that painted a better picture as to what was believed to have transpired. Ross Findlay had been a classmate of Titus Tidy Canfield. Through his personal research, he created a timeline of what he believed took place on the 25th of May, 1887. According to Ross's documents, Tidy had learned that there were Chinese miners in Hell's Canyon. Snooping around, he found out about their camp at Deep Creek, where they were looking for gold, and how long they'd been doing so, and in doing the math, figured they were probably in possession of a decent amount of gold. Armed with that information, Tidy approached his gang of friends slash criminals and proposed that they rob the men. It was reported that he sweetened the deal by offering them a cut of the gold bars that he and Blue had stolen from TJ. Once the six men agreed to the idea, they created a detailed plan. They made their way to a cabin near the river to prepare, a cabin once owned by TJ Douglas, the man they killed for the gold. In this version, one of the guys stayed at the cabin to tend to the horses. When the others arrived at the miners' camp, one went upstream, one went down. This was so they could be lookouts on the river for anyone that might be coming around who would blow their plan. If this attack was committed in this ambush manner, it's believed the other men went up on a hillside where, from afar, they used their rifles to shoot the miners. They killed the 30 to 40 men from there, but one of the Chinese men made an escape. He attempted to ride in a boat in hopes the water would carry him to safety, but the gang caught up to him and beat him to death with rocks. The gang then destroyed the camp and the men's supplies. That version of the story has me thinking two things. One being that perhaps the miners were hit with axes and mutilated by these men. If they were violent enough to beat someone with rocks, then they might have done that. On the other hand, I don't know how powerful rifles were in the 1800s, but I do find it hard to believe that from any kind of distance, these guys could accurately hit the miners, let alone multiple times in the back or the back of the head. That kind of sounds more like an up-close attack. I would venture to say that between articles and books about the story, someone has explored this aspect and goes into great detail, but based off of hearing that there were multiple shots to the back of several of the victims, that sounds kind of more execution style to me, but I'm not a gun expert. J. Harland Horner created his own version of events. The outcome of his research had him feeling that the gang was already together and making their way down the Snake River. When they got to the water, they began to cross, but their horses started to drown. So frantically, they got across where they stumbled upon the camp. In this version, finding the group of miners had been pure luck. The attack was simply a spur of the moment, hey, give us your boat and gold kind of decision. When the miners refused to give up their only way out of the canyon, the gang killed them. As I mentioned earlier, when the first bodies washed ashore, an investigation took place. It wouldn't be until about 4 months later when a man was taking his cattle through Hell's Canyon and he stumbled upon more remains and bodies that a second investigation would be initiated. This time it was headed by Wallowa County. One would think that the discovery of more victims would be headline news, but the paper didn't even mention it until 6 months after the fact. On April 29, 1888, nearly a year after the massacre, the New York Times had a story on their front page. In that article, it claimed Frank Vaughn's earlier confession included a plan that had been concocted long before the murders. After the murders, the gang gathered all of their plundered gold and handed it over to Tidy Canfield. He was supposed to take the gold, exchange it for coins, and redistribute it throughout the gang. Now, this might come as a shock, but it was reported that the murderous gang member took all of the gold and absconded from the county, leaving the men high and dry. No matter how the attack came to be, the names had been given to authorities and a grand jury had heard enough testimony to indict the gang for the murders. The murder trial that followed would be the first to take place in the newly formed Wallowa County. Blue Evans would not be facing those charges right after the murders, but before the bodies had washed ashore and word spread about the event, Blue was arrested for horse theft. Wallowa was so new it didn't yet have a jail, so Blue was taken to a hotel. There, he had a guard babysitting him 24/7. For 2 weeks, the hotel plan was working fine, but what the guards didn't know was that Blue's gang members were helping him on the outside. It's believed one had brought a horse to the area of the hotel and another had stashed a gun in the outhouse. So when Blue went to use the restroom, he easily escaped. From there, it's reported he made his way to Texas. He may have stayed there or moved to Montana, where it's believed he stayed for the remainder of his life. It's unknown if he ever reconnected with his wife and or children. Blue and Tidy were out of the picture. Frank Vaughn was a witness for the state. The number of accused who might face justice was dwindling. There is obviously so much more to the story. There are books on the case that go into detailed political angles that really played a part at the time. Those in positions of power who supported the Chinese and wanted to find answers were going up against those who didn't. Some who wanted to help the Chinese urged leaders in Wallawa to ask the federal government for help. When that request went ignored, those politicians reached out to the Chinese government, asking them to step in. But with limited communication and almost zero technology, that was futile. It would take until April 1888 for the remaining men to be arrested for the murders. It was around this time that state's witness Frank Vaughn would change his tune again. He claimed that what had taken place wasn't so much of a gang of six attacking the vulnerable men. It was more that Blue, Tidy, and Omar had decided to kill the men. Everyone else just, they were bystanders. As part of the investigation, and since there were more questions now that the narrative had changed, Carl Hughes was brought in for a deposition. Just like Frank, he claimed that he had had nothing to do with the murders. During questioning, neither the defense nor the prosecution asked about the gold. Where it was, how much they had taken, if they had known about the miners being there, if they had discussed having gold ripe for the taking, if the gold had been a motive for all the killings, not a word of it. A week after the arrests of the three remaining men, Hiram, Maynard, Carl Hughes, and Robert McMillan, a group of local men tracked down Circuit Court Judge Luther Isom while he was on vacation and petitioned him for release of the gang members who were jailed. The 34 men, including Harold Horner's father, the foreman of the grand jury for the case, property owners, and respected men of town, said that those arrested were being, quote, illegally held. Their protests were met with the answer they sought. Bail was set for all three men, and they were free until their trial. The two-day trial started August 30th. No transcripts of the trial remain, but Frank Vaughn was listed as a witness. One can assume he stuck to his news story, claiming the three men on trial hadn't been the ones who committed the murders. They merely watched as their friends robbed, shot, maimed, bludgeoned, and killed all those men. This was the outcome of whatever version of the story the jury was told. The state of Oregon versus Hiram Maynard and Robert McMillan and Hezekiah Hughes, indicted under the name of Carl Hughes, implicated with T.J. Canfield, Bruce Evans, and C.O. Lowry, defendants, we, the jury in the above entitled action, find the said defendants, Hiram Maynard, Robert McMillan, and Hezekiah Hughes, not guilty. A local rancher, George Craig, who attended the trial, was quoted as saying, I guess if they had killed 31 white men, something would have been done about it. But none of the jury knew the Chinamen or cared much about it, so they turned the men loose. These charges didn't hinder the men's ability to live full and successful lives. Frank Vaughn remained in Wallawa County, eventually becoming part of the school board. He was married and had children before ending up in California. H. Ross Findlay, one of the men who researched and wrote his own description of the incident, said that years after the trial, he and Frank became well acquainted and would even run cattle and hunt grizzly bears together. The men who weren't brought to trial went on with their lives. R. Gregory Noakes reported that Omar LaRue was shot dead playing cards. Robert McMillan is believed to have died from diphtheria, a bacterial infection of the nose and throat. 3 years later, his father would claim his son had confessed to having taken part in slaughtering the miners. From the Walla Walla Statesman, September 30th, 1891, under the headline, The Mystery Solved. I being Robert's father, make this statement from the statement made me by my son Robert, age 16, just prior to his death, and by me then reduced to writing. In the latter part of April 1887, my son and Bruce Evans, J.T. Canfield, Matt LaRue, Frank Vaughn, Hiram Maynard, and Carl Hughes were stopping in a cattle camp 4 miles from Snake River. My son and Evans, Canfield, LaRue, and Vaughn went to the Chinese camp on the Snake River. Canfield and LaRue went above the camp, and Evans and Vaughn remained below. There were 13 Chinese in that camp, and they were fired on. 12 Chinese were instantly killed, and one other caught afterwards and his brains beaten out. The party got that evening $5,500 in gold dust. Next day, 8 more Chinese came to the camp in a boat. They were all killed and their bodies with the others thrown into the river. The party then took a boat and went to another Chinese camp 4 miles distance from where 13 Chinese were working on a river bar. These were all killed and their bodies thrown into the river. The camp was robbed and $50,000 of gold secured. My son was present only the first day, but was acquainted with the facts as they were talked over by the parties in his presence. The circumstances here detailed occurred on the Oregon side of the Snake River in Wallowa County near the northeast corner of the state. So that version, to me, actually makes the most sense, that the men weren't up against 40 others and that they were actually taking them out one camp at a time. If all the miners had been in the same area, even with the six guns in possession by the gang, if not more, and they only had one 22 caliber rifle between all of them, it does seem like the miners could have physically overtaken the small gang if they had all gone onto the bank at the same time and if they had all been 34 together. Tidy Canfield didn't learn his lesson after the close call of being sent to prison or even receiving the death penalty. He wound up in Kansas, where he went to prison for mule theft. After release, it was reported in the newspaper that he had returned to Oregon in hopes of finding the gold he had buried. No word on if he ever struck it rich. After getting married and having a family in Texas, Tidy, now going by Charlie Canfield, wound up near Boise, Idaho, where he worked as a blacksmith. So much of the information surrounding this case now belongs to history, but there are some things we do know. These young, hardworking men were brutally attacked. Only a few of the possible 34 bodies were ever recovered. This made it extremely difficult to confirm their identities. Not only were there thousands of workers in the area from China, but some had sort of translated their names into English. Now, when you read a Chinese name in Chinese, you're actually informed of their family, their village, generation, their given name. You get a lot of information. But with their English versions, you lose all of that. It's unknown if the Sam Yup Corporation or the Chinese government ever learned about the arrests, the trial, the verdict. Not unrelated, in October of 1888, the U.S. government paid the Chinese $276,619, or nearly $10 million today, as full indemnity for all losses and injuries sustained by Chinese subjects within the United States and the lands of residence thereof. This was not a settlement that was focused strictly on what happened in Hell's Canyon. It was just kind of a generalized payment for all of the wrongdoings European Americans had committed against the Chinese. In 2005, a 5-acre portion of Deep Creek was renamed Chinese Massacre Cove to remember what happened to those men. In 2012, a memorial was placed at the site of the massacre to honor those who lost their lives. If you're in the Portland area, you can visit the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association, where you'll find a museum focused on the history of the Chinese population in Portland and to learn more about this case. If you are in the way northeast corner of Oregon or southeast Washington, you can check out Hell's Canyon or go on a Deep Creek tour and actually see not only the memorial, but some of the structures that the workers built that still stand. There's a great OPB special about this and a book titled Massacred for the Gold, The Chinese in Hell's Canyon by R. Gregory Noakes, if you want to dive deeper into this hidden and quite shameful piece of history. The Wallowa County Courthouse was built in 1909, not long after the original court held trial for the three men of the gang. To celebrate the new courthouse and the county's original settlers, they adorned the courthouse with an arch titled Wallowa County Pioneers and hung upon it plaques with the names of the first 199 settlers. Since Bruce Blue Evans came to Wallowa in 1879 and the plaques were dedicated to those who settled there from 1871 to 1879, his name was included on one of the plaques. This was long after he was well known for his horse thieving, jail escapes, and as a leader of a murderous gang. The event at Hell's Canyon is notable because over 30 men lost their lives in a horrible way. They were targeted because of their race, and justice for their deaths was dismissed for the same reason. Placing the marker has been a great step, but of course that has not changed how Asian Americans are treated. Xinming Lang lived in a downtown Portland apartment. A perk of living downtown? It's just a walk or a very short drive across the Steel or Burnside bridges to the East Bank Esplanade, an area with walking trails and floating docks for fishing, an activity Xinming enjoyed daily. Around 9:30 a.m. on March 12th of this year, he was peacefully fishing on the dock when a man approached him. Without saying a single word, the man raised a 5-inch-long, club-like piece of wood and started to beat Xinming on the head. He protected himself with his arms, and after several strikes, the stick broke. With his weapon broken, the man walked away. Worried he would return, Xinming grabbed a stick of his own. When the attacker turned around and began walking toward him again, he grabbed his catches of the day and the blue beanie that had fallen off the attacker's head. He then ran for a MAC stop, hopped on the train, and went back home to his wife. No one on the train called for help, even though there was blood dripping from this man's face and head. It wasn't until his apartment manager saw his condition that 911 was called. Jinmin hadn't done it himself because he speaks Cantonese and Mandarin, and he didn't know that 911 has a translation line. If someone calls for help, they can use that line to identify the language and get the person the translator they need. Once at the hospital, the severity of the attack was shocking to Jinmin and his family. The doctor said that the force used by the attacker would have killed him if he hadn't blocked the blows with his arms. He was diagnosed as being concussed. He needed stitches on his face and eye, and one of his arms was broken in three places, which required surgery. Zhai Liang, Jinmin's daughter, told reporters her father and mother, who moved to Oregon from China in 2015 to be closer to her and her husband, have since moved in with her for some time, as they are terrified to be in Portland. They are hopeful that the Portland police will be able to catch the attacker based off DNA recovered from the beanie that Jinmin had the wherewithal to pick up as he escaped. PPB released the following statement: "This is an open and active investigation, and detectives are working diligently to locate the suspect." Ji, the daughter, told Oregon Live, "Racism is something we, me and my parents, only experienced when we came to America." The family has a GoFundMe to help with medical bills, recovery, and all of those expenses that come with being a victim. You can find it by searching for Jinmin Liang, which is Jinmin Liang. They are also asking that if anyone, and I do realize it's been months now, but it's worth putting out there, who lived in the area and maybe had a doorbell video or a security video from March 12th, to check it for a white man about 5'8" wearing gray clothing and a blue beanie. And as you can hear, nothing's really changed, because just like the stories from 100-something years ago where a guy was walking down the street and getting pelted with things, just 2 months ago, we had the same thing happen. So there you go. That's Hell's Canyon.
It was great to hear a redo of a case. And I remember that episode, and the level of information you've brought to sort of remake is a higher level. You're better at this than you used
to
be.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's funny because we had a lot of feedback from that first airing too. Remember, there was a teacher that played it in their classroom, remember? Because it's a piece of history that isn't talked about.
Right. Thanks to the USDA, we know that it was a hand-signed, adding that D.
Careful with all that width and length talk around Emily. She's getting frothed up.
I'm going to have to put some garbage bags on her seat to keep the cushion dry.
Oh, something absorbent, a chamois of some sort.
You too.
Juice chamois.
Well, as we say when Stanley Tucci has a bad movie, he made a mistooch.
Dr. Henry Jones? What did you say?
Yeah, Dr. Henry Jones.
You mean Indiana Jones?
Oh, is that his name?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. In Jackson, Oregon, say read the words.
Adelbert.
No, they're all foreign.
Adelbert. What a legacy.
Yeah. I know. I was like, I don't need to put everyone's name, but what if you live in Tacoma and you're like, wait, that's my great great granddaddy. Now it all makes sense. I hope that happens.
Why it's been so awful.
Gmail us.
Because your grandpa's racist.
But the sheriff deputized. Oh my God. Oh, hi, little stinker. Not my burp, the stink bug in front of me. That's what I say when I'm about to fart. Oh.
It smells like a Costco hot dog, but I had no Costco
but
hot
I had
dog.
Pasta. How did this happen? When you listen to that, you're going to hear Josh. You scared me when you started
It
scared me when I went,
Hiram Maynard.
Tidy Whitey?
I know.
Tidy Whitey.
That's his, he's working on a horror movie.
I'm Tidy Whitey.
Look out for my streaks.
Ew.
Okay. One would think that... David Duchovny. And redistributed it. Oh my God, I'm having a hard D day.
I already had one too.
Yeah, you did. The other men were merely bystanders. Why can't I say bystanders? Bystanders?
Bystanders.
Bystanders. Bystanders?
It sounds weird.
That sounds insane.
But it's not.
Bystanders.
Is it bystanders?
Yeah. Like you're standing
everyone
by.
Everyone else was bystanders.
So without the extra D, it sounded weird.
Bystanders. Oh my God. No.
Bystanders.
Bystanders.
Yeah. You could say witnesses or...
All the other men were merely bystanders.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. That's Jesus. Right.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know why
making
it sounded
words
so
over
wrong.
Here? It did. Oh, God.
And I'm like, bystanders.
Yeah, I'm like, that doesn't feel... Nothing feels right anymore. Indicated under... Indicted, you fucking... Cow. Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.